ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय even if threatened by decapitation, they remain unagitated. For them, this is not at all wonderful. Report, these are some of the great qualities of a pure devotee of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. First, a devotee is convinced of his spiritual identity. He never identifies with the body. He is firmly convinced that the spirit soul is different from the body. Consequently, he fears nothing. Even though his life may be threatened, he is not at all afraid. He does not even treat an enemy like an enemy. Such are the qualifications of devotees. Devotees are always fully dependent on the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and the Lord is always eager to give them all protection in all circumstances. Thus then the Bhaktivedanta purports of the 5th canto, 9th chapter of Srimad Bhagavatam entitled The Supreme Character of Janamana. So this summarizes the theme of this particular chapter, and that is one that Janamana was a great devotee of the Lord. He was not simply a renounced person, but the renunciation was simply the result of his absorption in the Supreme Lord. Because he was a great devotee of the Lord protected him in all circumstances. Though he had a material body, or a so-called material body, which was subject to material energy, heat and cold, seasons, dacoits capturing, etc., he was not disturbed in any circumstance because he was simply absorbed in the Supreme Lord. The Supreme Lord, on the other hand, protected him. We see that in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna promises that he will take care of the devotee, even if the devotee is unaware of his body, somehow the Lord makes arrangements so that his body goes on, etc. So this is the characteristic of advanced devotees. They are unaware of their material existence. Nevertheless, their existence continues in this world. The Lord has a purpose. Of course, the devotee would prefer to be in the spiritual world and just give up his material body because it's useless and it's an obstacle to prema. Nevertheless, the Lord often keeps these devotees in the material world. Yeah? And therefore, the Lord maintains them. He takes care of their bodies. The devotees are indifferent to their bodies, but the Lord takes care of them in any case. And we see this is the example given here. Jadvara was indifferent to being sacrificed to God. Whether he lived or died really didn't matter, so he didn't protest when they grabbed him. And he was strong, very strong, as we see later on, but he didn't in any way resist these dacoits. And he simply agreed to be tied up and bathed and offered, and then Kali himself came and rescued him and killed all the demons, as explained in the previous verses, because of the offense of these dacoits by trying to harm a devotee of the Lord. They got punished through the agency of Kali herself, who was the object of the devotion of the dacoits. So the Lord takes care of these devotees in all cases. And so, what are the qualities of the devotees? And so that is mentioned in this particular verse. They know the soul is separate from the body. So this is, of course, not unique to devotional service, because Gyanis and Yogis also have such a realization. Even people in Sattva-gun generally understand they're not the body or soul, because that's a quality of Sattva-gun. Within Sattva-gun itself, we have Vidya. Of course, we have two aspects of Maya. Avidya, which is the normal one we think of, but Vidya is also an aspect of Maya. So that's the positive aspect. Maya Devi herself gives you a little knowledge, spiritual knowledge, if that's within Sattva-gun. And that knowledge is that you're not the body, you're the Sa'atma. So if you come to Sattva-gun, then you can have some sort of faith that you're spiritual, not the body. That is why we see many people who are a little bit refined and not practicing vegetarianism or whatever. But then, at least they can understand, oh, I'm not the body or something, and they have a spiritual inclination. So, if one comes to Sattva-gun, a spiritual inclination is a natural characteristic of that Sattva-gun, and someone begins to inquire, and one is willing to follow some spiritual practice or meditation or whatever. Sattva-gun, however, is not complete. It does not give complete spiritual knowledge. So, what is it, other knowledge? Sattva-gun does not give you awareness of Krishna or Supreme Lord. It gives you some awareness of Atma. To that extent, it is fine. But it's not complete. It doesn't give you knowledge of Supreme Lord. So, we should never think that bhakti is a result of Sattva-gun. And if we come to Sattva-gun, then we naturally progress to bhakti. No. The natural progression is jnana. So you can become a jnani as a result of Sattva-gun, and then you can think of Brahman and impersonalism. So that's the extent that you can get out of Sattva-gun. So this is part of the gradual process of purification in the Vedas. You do karma yoga, follow varnashram, and if you're very attached, you do what is called sakama karma yoga, and you get attached to the results, which we also call karma kanda, and you try to get some nice results from your activities, regulated activities of sacrifices and vratas and charities, etc. And eventually you can go to svargaloka and things like that. That's the lower part of karma yoga for people in tamaguna and rajaguna. And by following those rules and regulations and controlling the senses, gradually we get elevated. And then they start practicing Nishkama Karma Yoga, the same activities, but without desire for results. And this brings them to Sattva-guna. And in Sattva-guna, they continue the practice of Nishkama Karma Yoga, but then they develop an idea, okay, I'm not the body, and become very detached, and then they're qualified for Jnana Yoga. And then they can understand, I'm not the body, I'm the soul, and then they strive for liberation. So these are the preliminary steps towards bhakti. Karma Yoga, Sakama Karma Yoga, desires, Nishkama Karma Yoga without desires, and gradually the Sattva going, then we get into Jnana Yoga, which is definitely Sattva going. You need to be Sattva going before you can do Jnana Yoga. You cannot study Vedanta unless you're very brahminical. So that's not even study or Atma, etc. And then you may go on to Ashtanga Yoga, be a little practical to get some realization of Atma. Once you've got some idea of Atma, then you can progress to understanding Supreme Atma, Paramatma, as in yoga, and then Bhagavan. But it's not automatic. It's not that you just go through the glimmers and then you develop bhakti automatically. So that's why Karma Yoga is not a direct cause of bhakti. And Jnana is not a direct cause of bhakti. In fact, Jnana can be the opposite. Because it concentrates on the impersonal, it can be a disqualification of the bhakti. And Karma Yoga, because there's some attachment to material results, can also be a disqualification of the bhakti. But they are favorable in the sense that they help raise a jiva in the lower modes of nature to at least Sattva-guna. And where you can control the senses and develop some spiritual interest. So that is the favorable aspect of these different processes. But the direct cause of bhakti is nothing material. And so Karma Yoga and Jnana Yoga are in the gunas. Nistra Gunya Bhavarjuna should be beyond the gunas. So bhakti is beyond the gunas. So something in the gunas cannot create bhakti correctly. So what causes bhakti? Bhakti. Only bhakti is beyond the gunas and it can cause bhakti. We can say secondarily there's a little bhakti in Karma Yoga and Jnana Yoga, and that can help you elevate, etc. And it may be a secondary cause of developing bhakti's principal sadhana, but it's a little bit contaminated in most cases. So therefore the direct cause of bhakti is bhakti itself. Of course we say that shraddha is a qualification for bhakti. But where does shraddha come from? That comes from mercy of not direct bhakti, but agyata sukriti bhakti, which is caused by devotees over many lifetimes. So therefore that means that bhakti is the cause of faith through agyata sukriti, where we do accidental bhakti, and caused by devotees. Then we develop faith. When we get faith, then we get the mercy of devotees to begin the practice of bhakti. Okay. So bhakti causes bhakti, not other processes. That's the direct cause of pure bhakti. So therefore, it's nirguna. So ultimately, bhakti is not dependent on the other processes at all. But going through the gunas and understanding you're not the body, etc., they're favorable and help you also advance. But we'll find that some people, they're in lower gunas, but suddenly they become devotees also, because they develop faith. So tamagun persons can develop faith and develop bhakti, etc. It's not that you have to go through all these systems over many, many lifetimes to get to Sattva Guna and then begin to practice bhakti. Now, so that is why the process of bhakti, and particularly chanting the holy name, is open to everybody. If they have faith, they can take to the process, and that, and even if they're lower gunas or whatever. We may think, of course, well, generally is people in the subtle one who will take to bhakti. It may be so. It may not be so also, because if you're in subtle one and you understand you're not the body, you're the atma, then you may be inclined to impersonalism. And then when you get an impersonalism, this is also an obstruction to bhakti. So therefore, it's more difficult. So people may become very brahminical, but they may be studying Shankara's Vedanta. So therefore, that's unfavorable. And it's very difficult for them to become devotees. And you can argue with them for a lifetime. They won't change their ideas and accept the supreme form of the Lord at all. And they won't accept bhakti. So it becomes more difficult for them sometimes to develop the bhakti if they're stuck in sattva-guna and then become impersonalists. So the gunas all have their pluses and minuses. Of course, in the lower modes, unfavorable, because you have great material attachments. And ignorance, of course, is very unfavorable for bhakti. Each mode of nature has some problem with it. But even sattva-guna has a problem. In any case, bhakti overcomes all the gunas. We see cases of people on the sattva and above. They can impersonalize and become attracted to bhakti also. So we see that Madhvacharya, he converted many impersonalist Shankarites into his devotees. Same with Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, converted the Sannyasis and Varanasi. Then we find other examples of people in the mode of ignorance, like Murgari the Hunter, very tamasic, like to kill animals and watch them die. But by the mercy of Narada Muni, a great devotee in a few months. Well, of course, as Kripa City, 3 months he got Baba. But it just shows that you don't have to go through the gunas gradually to get to bhakti. He started out, I'll throw down my bow and arrow and I won't kill any more animals. That was his qualification. He listened to Narada Muni and then he started practicing bhakti. In any mode of material nature, we can see that people can advance. In this story here, we have Rahugan later on, who was a king, so largely a Rajagun. But he listened to Jagbara somehow or other, listen to his teaching, and then he changed himself completely by the mercy of Jagbara. So one can advance from any guna and take to the process of bhakti if the faith is generated, sincere faith and pure bhakti is generated, then one can practice. And it doesn't require you to first go through all the gunas and come to sattva guna and then take to bhakti. It's an independent process. The devotee, as mentioned here in this particular verse, understands the soul is separate from the body. So that is a preliminary only. That's not an ultimate characteristic, because people in sattva-guna and gyanis and yogis also understand it, but they may be impersonalists. So this is not a final qualification, but it is a secondary byproduct of developing bhakti. One understands that the body is temporary and material, etc., then one becomes completely detached from it. And then the next character is liberated from the invincible knot in the heart. So this is a further advancement to understanding you're not the body, but you're the aha. One is liberated from the invincible knot in the heart. So we see this term often used, knot in the heart. Grunty. So it often refers to ahankara, which is very difficult to get rid of. We may get rid of karmas, we may conquer over our desires, but still, very difficult to get rid of that knot in the heart, where we still identify somehow or other with our material body and with our desires, and have that desire to enjoy the material world. So it's a very, very subtle form of identity, and takes a long time to destroy. And in fact, when one performs devotional service, many of the karmas are dissipated immediately, as in the case of Ajna. And of course, if one commits some sort of offenses, the process is more gradual. But by the end of a sati, there should be no more karmas. But the hankara is still there a little bit in bhava stage, and that gets destroyed ultimately in bhava stage, the ahankara. And that allows you to go further into prema. And so ahankara, very that invincible knot in the heart, is more difficult to destroy than the karmas. So the devotee of the Lord, in the case of Jadvara, of course, goes to prema, so therefore he's free from all this identification of ahankara. And he's engaged in welfare activities for all living beings, which sometimes we say, well, that looks a little bit materialistic. You go out and open hospitals and schools and things like that. Why would we want to do that? Because Prabhupada said that we don't involve with these things, they're all material activities, supplemental activities. Okay? So we should not think that engaging in the welfare activities is the same as this material sattva. The devotee engages in activities for the welfare of the people, but he's thinking of spiritual benefit, not material benefit. So because the devotee understands that ultimately, no matter how much material benefit you give, is very temporary. So the best thing is to give them spiritual benefit, by spiritual education somehow or other. So the devotee is of this nature, wanting to benefit all humanity. Why? Because this is a natural quality of the Supreme Lord, and it's a natural quality that also develops in the devotee. If we associate with materialists, we develop all materialistic qualities. If we associate with the Supreme Lord of the bhakti, we will develop qualities like the Supreme Lord. If we develop all opposite qualities when we're trying to do bhakti, then how can we communicate with the Lord? We're completely different personalities. So by association with the Lord, we tend to develop similar types of qualities. And then there's great sympathy and affection between the Lord and the devotee. So one of the most important qualities there is that compassion for all living entities. The Supreme Lord has that as his nature. And we often say, ocean of mercy. The Lord is an ocean of mercy. And devotee also becomes full of mercy also. And of course, we don't see the Lord going out and everybody suffering the karmas in the material world. Say, okay, stop all the karmas, they take you out of the material world and you're liberated. He doesn't say that. He helps people in different ways. But he's always looking for their spiritual upliftment. That's the main thing. And therefore he comes in the material world as avatar to teach bhakti. He sends the devotees into the material world to teach bhakti. And all the jivas that take to the process of bhakti, they also develop this quality of wanting to help others. So the devotee of the Lord acts as the instrument of the Lord's mercy. The Lord himself does not manifest himself always in the material world, because the avatars aren't there all the time. But the devotees are there all the time. And so for the Lord empowers the devotees on his behalf to give out that mercy. And so they're instruments of the Supreme Lord. This is particularly prominent in Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's movement. Because Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's, one of his goals is to uplift even the most unqualified, offensive people of Kali Yuga and deliver them. Not to give them houses and hospitals, not, but to give them prema for Radha and Krishna. So Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was most merciful. He's Mahabhadanya. Therefore, he started the preaching movement of Nam Sankirtan. And Nam Sankirtan has no limits. It's for everybody. It's a preaching tool to connect everybody to Krishna. Lord Chaitanya has this mood of preaching and uplifting everyone.
chant my name in every town and village, etc., and spread all over the world. Anyone you meet, teach them about Krishna. So, a very, very active preacher. So that's one of the qualities of Prajapati's movement. Jiva-yoga, to give mercy to all Jeeves. But the other, what's the counter principle there? Not that we should get involved in preaching, but Nama Ruchi. We also have to develop a taste for the holy name. So we have to develop spiritually also. But then simultaneously, we're also trying to uplift other Jivas in this material world. So it's a two-pronged effort. Lord Chaitanya comes to deliver us, and then we help him take in that process of bhakti and nam sankirtan, and we also help to deliver others. Both through the same process, chanting the holy name. So we deliver ourselves through nam sankirtan, and we deliver others and preach to others through nam sankirtan. The same process for both. But that's the main thrust of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's movement, to give out that mercy, show compassion to all the deities in this way. So that's where how the compassion is expressed, engaged in welfare activities for all living entities. Then it says they never contemplate harming anybody. This is also intrinsic to bhakti, though it looks a little bit more like sattva, okay. And sattva will become vegetarian, whatever, non-violent, and all this. But that's also a quality of the devotee, because the devotee understands that all the living entities in the material world are there by their karmas, and we should not interfere with their development by killing them or harming them in any way. On the other hand, we should try to benefit them for their advancement. One of the rules of bhakti, of course, is that we respect all living entities. Of course, Lord Chaitanya and Shastaka also says, give respect, amanada, and don't respect for ourselves. That refers not only to people, but animals and plants as well. And if we look at nectar devotion there, in the preliminaries of bhakti, the first 20 items are there, which are like the door to bhakti. One of those items there, I think it's number 9, yeah, something like that, or 10 maybe, is you give respect to the aswata tree and the whatever, and brahmanas and vaishnavas and plants and animals and whatever, the cows and whatever. So we respect all living entities. That's the preliminary to bhakti, actually. And then I think the 19th item, which is the second group of 10 items, which are the things you shouldn't do, like don't collect money and don't make any disciples for profit, and don't study too many books, try to defeat other people, don't engage in big projects where you don't have any abilities and things like this, don't be overcome by lamentation, all sorts of material emotions, don't commit aparadhas, don't disrespect the devatas, don't tolerate offenses against the devotees. That's very hard. And then one of them is don't interfere with other living entities. Don't disturb any living entities. This is a rule, basic rule of bhakti. Yeah. But it's also that non-violence is inherent in the process of bhakti itself. The nature of the devotee is non-violent and respects all living entities as the servants of the Supreme Lord. And therefore, he doesn't interfere with them and disturb them. So these are the qualities of the devotee. Of course, that's not the main quality. Then we find this other quality mentioned here. He's always under the protection of the Supreme Lord. Yeah, and the devotee always takes shelter of the lotus feet of the Lord. So that's the main quality. The devotee takes shelter of the lotus feet of the Lord. And then all of these qualities are naturally manifested. And the result of that is the Lord protects the devotee. The main quality here of Jadvara is he felt he was under the shelter of the Lord at all times. Consequently, he had all these remarkable qualities. And the result was Lord protected him.
So the description here is quite apt. Dacoits got their deserving goal. They all got decapitated by the servants of Kali. Got their blood drunk. So that was their punishment for offending the devotee. Okay, any questions?
What's the root cause for the Shraddha?
Root cause of Shraddha?
Yeah.
Well, as I said, it's mercy of devotees. It's not that everybody just naturally goes so many lifetimes and start developing faith and from faith to bhakti. It's not a natural thing in the material world. It requires some special input. So bhakti causes bhakti. So it is. But then if you're not a devotee and you don't have faith, you don't want to do any bhakti, obviously. Why would you do bhakti if you don't have any faith in it? So the only way you can do the bhakti is accidentally. Like chanting the name Narayan or something when it's naming your son, or chanting the name of Rama when it means Haram. I'm unfortunate because the impure pig is touching me and he's contaminating me. So he says Haram. So he says the name of Rama there. So this is accidental chanting. It's only through that accidental type of bhakti that one can advance, but it's some sort of association with the Lord. So the main persons who engage people in that accidental bhakti are the devotees. And by doing repeated acts, accidental acts of bhakti, where you don't have any faith, and it just happens to, like taking prasadam, life after life you take prasadam, thinking it's nice, tastes nice or something like that, and then eventually the jiva gets affected by that accidental prasadam or whatever, hearing the holy name, seeing the form of the deity, gradually it begins to change a little bit, and then the faith develops. So it's usually by the intervention of devotees somehow or other. It's called agata sukriti.
So can't be a mode of sattva-guna, or why it cannot be a reason for...
Why can't it?
Yeah.
Because sattva is material. And what is sattva guna? You have all the qualities of a brahmana, etc. Sense control, etc. And faith in scripture. All these different qualities are there. But they are actually qualities which arise from sattva guna. Now, as I said, bhakti is non-material. So how can something in the gunas give rise to something non-material?
Bhakti is independent. Does Shraddha,
like,
the basic fundamental Shraddha?
Yes, so Shraddha also is the precursor of bhakti, so that's also transcendental. It is also nirguna. And therefore arises by mercy of devotees. So that's transcendental. And then they, life after life, they get a little more influence of that bhakti, accidental bhakti, and then the faith develops. So that's also actually... We say that a trace of that shakti of bhakti is there in that also. We distinguish the shraddha from the bhakti because when we do the bhakti, then we begin to do some activities for the Lord with that faith. Based on the faith, okay, I accept Supreme Lord, I accept what Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, then we're willing to offer a flower to Krishna with the idea we want to please Krishna. Before that, it's maybe accidental, or we don't do it at all if we don't have any faith. But with that faith, then we do the activities of bhakti. So in that sense, the faith is a preliminary to hear, accept the knowledge from devotees, sadhu sangha, and then begin the actions of bhakti.
You initially in the lecture, you were saying maya gives some knowledge.
Yeah. Vidya is part of Maya.
And then we see in Bhagavad Gita, Maya, Vidya, Jnana, Maya takes away knowledge. And in the spiritual world also, the knowledge of relationship with Krishna is taken away. I'm trying to understand the role of Maya is to keep the devotees away from Krishna. Is that the goal? So that whatever is required, you can give or take.
Well, we have two Mayas actually. We have the yoga Maya in the spiritual world, in which the devotees have an apparent ignorance of something, so that the Lord can perform his pastimes. Like the gopis are thinking, oh, these are our husbands and we're married, and you know they're causing obstacles, but actually they're not the husbands at all. Well, that's like yoga Maya there. So there's lots of aspects of yoga Maya. It's covered the knowledge so that the pastimes can take place, because if everybody knew everything about everything, we'd just sit there. But then they go out in the morning and they, you know, the cowherd boys go out with Krishna, and they're excited about what's going to happen that day. But if they knew what's going to happen already, then there would be no excitement. So, and even Krishna gets excited. So he also gets affected by this. We see the example in the Agasura pastime, where the cowherd boys are running into the mouth of Agasura, and then Krishna says, "Don't do that, don't do that," but they don't even hear him. And then Krishna's really astonished. He says, "Why are they doing this?" And he says, "Oh, it's my yoga maya police. He's doing all this." So he gets astonished sometimes by what yoga maya does. It, you know, covers people up. But it's for spiritual pastime. So that's not the normal ignorance. Right? They're still all related to Krishna. So the other maya is the maya in the material world, which is an illusion. Now we have ignorance and avidya, etc. Ahankara. You get karma and desires and all this is offshoots of the material ignorance. So this is maya, this is the shakti of the Lord, also external energy of the Lord, with its gross and its subtle aspects, the material property and then the subtle aspects like karma and material identity, etc., vidya, etc. All this is material world, external energy of the Lord. So it only operates under the will of the Lord. It's also under the will of the Lord. So the Lord casts his glance, and then suddenly Prakriti begins to activate and create material worlds, and then push the jivas into the material worlds with all their karmas. And it's all under the direction of the Supreme Lord, but within that, each jiva has his own little free will by which he can make choices and improve his karma. That's all his free will. It's not that he's forced to act in that way. He gradually advances, and if he gets a little advantage, if he's in the Varnashram system, then he can gradually advance from Tamagun to Rajagun to Sattvagun, and go from Sudra to Vaishya to Brahma Kshatriya over many lifetimes. And there's a little system of, therefore, advancement. If he agrees to follow this, if he doesn't agree to it, then he's just kind of at random going up and down in the material world. And then once you get to Sattva, then, as I said, Sattvagun has Vidya in it. So then, let's not be attracted to all these material things, all temporary, body's temporary, so I should understand I'm the Atma and I should strive for higher goals, then we start practicing jnana. So we, at least we start getting out of the material world at that point. And so that's as far as material arrangements. So the gunas are arranged by Krishna to help us get out. So then the other aspect is, he puts devotees in the material world to take you beyond the gunas completely. Because just with this sattva-guna, you cannot really get out. And even with jnana, with no bhakti, you cannot get out of the material world. So there has to be some bhakti somewhere in there, even for jnana and for karma yoga, to give some results. But if you want to think directly to pure bhakti, then you need the intervention of devotee's mercy somewhere along the line. So that maya is functioning only in relation to the jiva's desires. That Jesus choose, I do not want to serve the Lord. I don't want to recognize the Lord. I want to enjoy for myself. These are the jivas that have all the karmas and get stuck in the material world. And the Lord only creates a material world because all the jivas are sleeping inside Mahavishnu. But they do have previous karmas and previous creations. But then they get a little agitated somehow. And when that agitation builds up, they say, okay, let's put them in another world again, because they want to enjoy the material, so it creates another material universe and sticks all the jivas back in, and then they can start their bodies again from where they left off in a previous universe and go through this whole cycle of trying to advance and go through the gunas until they get to, you know, suck the gun, or they get the mercy of devotees. So it's those desires of the demons to stay in the material world that he creates this world for. But then he has these little devices by which they can get out. That is going to Sattva-guna, getting jnana, and getting mercy of devotees by which they can get bhakti. So that's the compassion of the Lord. But if people don't want, okay, leave some there in the pure world. So he doesn't force them. So the free will of the jiva is also operating.
I want to end this last time. Of course, the exalted state of Jagannath's surrender to the Lord. He is not trying to do anything to protect himself. And then we also see now that Kali is coming and chopping her own her own worshippers and protecting the devotee.
Mm-hmm.
So both of them are devotees. So we hear a lot on Jagannath. Is there anything where it sort of depicts what's happening in Kali's mind? Mind, or is it just a direct intervention of the Lord?
Well, no, we don't have in the Bhagavatam, there's no other description of this. But then, through this example, we can understand that Kali is appreciative of the great devotees of the Lord and understands that the Lord always protects the devotees. We have so many verses where the Lord says, I'm the servant of my devotee, etc. And I don't really care for people practicing jnana and sankhya and varnashram and all that, but I do care for my devotee. Huh? So the devotees also understand that principle. They're also devotees of the Lord. So they understand that. And if anyone interferes with the devotees, then they will also take some action if necessary. Just like Krishna comes in the material world because he says, when, you know, my devotees, I come to save my devotees and protect them from the demons, etc., like that. So that's the intention of the Lord. So the devotees are also doing that to some degree in their position. When they can't do it anymore, then they go to the Supreme Lord or they go to Brahma or someone and complain. Look, it comes as, you know, he's harassing too much and we can't do anything about it. So then they pray to the Supreme Lord. But if they can, then the devotees also are protecting. They're also devotees of the Lord. Then we have on a lesser level, then we have the kings, the descendants of Manu. They're also empowered, the devotees of the Lord like devatas. And they're there to rule over the world, to institute dharma, and protect bhakti. And they carry out their duties like that. And some of them are very great devotees, like Dhruva or Ambarish. So in this way, we can say the devatas are also devotees of the Lord, and they appreciate bhakti. Service of the Lord. Sometimes they all name that we shouldn't worship David or whatever, but they're also devotees of the Lord. So they appreciate the devotees and they understand the intentions of the Lord, so they also help out and protect devotees and whatever.
Muslims in Chaitanya Sahasrarita, they refer to the devotees as haram and they make advancement by using that devotees.
Mm-hmm.
At this moment, as far as I understand, Muslims use the word haram to refer to anyone other than their sect. So
okay.
Is that Namavasan?
It's Namavasan. Because of the Ram.
Yeah. And how long does it take for the Tyagyatasukriti to convert into faith?
It usually takes a long time. Because it's accidental and it's without attention or whatever, no faith. So it takes some time for those persons to advance. But it does have some immediate effect if there's no aparana. It won't give you prema, it won't give you faith, but it does destroy your karma, as in the case of Ajivanu. He didn't have any faith and he didn't have any aparana also. So then when he said, oh, I name you Narayana, then all those karmas disappear. So it has some effect. It doesn't create faith immediately, but at least you can destroy your karmas or whatever.
Okay. And just the other one, you mentioned briefly about Rupa and Sadhana.
Yeah.
I was thinking about Sadhana Siddha and Rupa Siddha. that a sadhana is a definite priest perfection unless he gets kripa. So they're all recipients of kripa.
Yeah. So yeah, in any case, whether it's sadhana said or purposely, there must be kripa. There must be mercy. When we talk about kripa siddhi, it means there's a sudden advancement, not just gradual advancement. So, for instance, with the regarding the hunter, Narada Muni chastised the hunters, if you can't do this, and if you are really serious, and you're bowing down to him like this, if you're really serious, then you give up your bow and arrow, and just stop that profession completely, and you sit down with your wife, and you chant the holy name, don't worry about your maintenance or whatever. And then he did that. 3 months later, he came back with Parvati Muni, I think it was. And then Parvati said, oh, look at him. Because he was bowing down to Narada Muni very enthusiastically, and then he saw the ants in the road, so he brushed away the ants. He didn't want to injure the bugs because he would pay his obeisances and crush them. So Parvati said, oh, wow, he's very advanced. So how did this happen? So how did he come? And he came to Baba stage, actually, in 3 months. So that's an example of Kripa Siddhi. It was only the Kripa Narada Muni in the holy name that it could happen like that. Otherwise, it would be a long process. So that's the quick advancement. Sometimes someone may get prema immediately. Or when Krishna kills a demon like Putana and they go to the spiritual world immediately, even though they have no qualification at all, it's like getting touched, killed by the Lord. So that's Kripa again, Kripa Siddhi. But that's unusual. Usually, we advance by sadhana, and we go through the different stages, you know, like nishtha, ruchiya, sakti, bhava, prema, it's a gradual process. I mean, Bharata's an example of that. He got bhava stage, he fell, became a deer, then he got to prema, so it took 3 lifetimes to go upward again. It wasn't instantaneous. And of course, before that, he was king, so practicing. Before that, we don't know previous lifetime, but you know, gradual process of advancement there. And in that process, you also need mercy. Yeah? So we always need mercy of devotees to advance. So mercy is there, and that mercy of the devotees is ultimately coming from Krishna. Mm-hmm. So mercy is in both cases is there, but when we talk about Kripa Siddhi, that means there's a sudden advancement, and suddenly we get bhava or prema. Mm-hmm.
We hear that the mind being influenced by the three modes, maybe from the external according to the time, place, etc. And at the same time, we also hear that the three modes is a constituent of mind or other matter as a basis. So how is that? Is the both?
How is it?
Is it the constituent as a
what?
The matter, the three modes?
A constituent of matter, and what's the other thing?
The influence.
Well, in Prakriti, before it's agitated by the glance of Mahavishnu, we don't see gunas. When he throws his glance and injects the jivas, suddenly it's a little agitated in a manifest sattva, and that's mahatattva. Once that disturbance takes place and a guna appears, then gradually that guna turns into rajaguna, which is called sutra, and then it turns into tamaguna, which is called ahankara. So we get another element coming out from prakriti and mahatattva, and we get ahankara. And then when ahankara comes up, then it divides up into a sattvic portion with the mind and the devatas, and the rajasic portion, the senses, and sense objects, and then the tamaguna portion, the material elements, 5 material elements, and then that forms material worlds. So we say that the gunas are there within prakriti as qualities of prakriti, but they don't manifest until, you know, the Lord glances and then we get sattva, and from that it kind of evolves on its own, like some chemical or something, you stick a little thing in its finger, actually starts transforming into something else. So that little stimulus of the Lord produces the sattvic thing, and then the sattva turns into rajas and tamas, and then starts combining in different ways. So we say it's a constituent of matter itself. And then, of course, because it's its quality, it will manifest in different things in this world.
Mm-hmm.
and Shraddha, faith. So Shraddha, faith means that that we have to accept Krishna as the Supreme Person of the Godhead, then only the faith develops. Because we see that most of the people were Indian background, so they have faith that Krishna is God, but they usually don't take to chanting or to serve the God. They just have a faith that Krishna is God. So,
but they may have a faith, oh, also Shiva's God and Durga's God. It's like, so that's not real faith. When we talk about Krishna as God is faith, and by serving Him alone, everything is accomplished. That is faith. So in other words, He's the highest or independent person, or Vishnu, either way. So that type of faith is there. And faith in is a faith in pure bhakti, not mixed bhakti or something else.
So the jivas will have that faith that Krishna is a supreme. Mm-hmm. So then only they can actually progress in bhakti.
Yeah. Otherwise, what happens is we end up with namaparads, like Vishnu and Krishna are equal, or Shiva and Vishnu are equal, or things like that, or the names are equal, or that chanting the holy name is like Kamakanda, you go to Svargaloka only, you know, things like this. So, you know, we do have to have that understanding, first of all, and accept that the Lord is on a higher position, a spiritual position, and uncontaminated by material nature, and different than devatas.
Hare Krishna. Maharaj, I have a question. That you mentioned bhakti, the nature of God, the nature of bhakti is compassion, and not only to human beings but all living entities, animal plants. So when we are living practically in the world and we have to clean our houses, we sometimes tend to kill some ants or spiders or cockroaches.
Yeah.
So, does that affect our bhakti in any way?
Uh-huh. Well, even in the karma, there is a little prescription for that, because they understand that in your daily activities, like sweeping the floor or lighting a fire, you're going to kill something, or like this. So, they have something called the Pancha Mahayagyas they're supposed to do every day, which means you offer, you recite the Vedas, the Brahma Yagya, you worship the Devatas, and Vishnu and Archana, Puja, you worship the Pitras. You worship humans in the form of welcoming guests into your house and feeding them. And you worship all living entities by giving some food to the animals. Like this. So you're supposed to do these five things every day, and this will absolve you of all your little accidental things. So when you're cleaning your house and lighting your fire and breathing or drinking water or whatever. So that's the karma aspect of it. So the on the hand of the bhakti, if we're engaged in devotional service, that's even better. So that's what Krishna says, no more karma. Aham tamasva papabhyo moksha syami. I free you from all sins. So those are automatically taken care of.
Story of Jayabharat. Initially, when Bharat Maharaj became a deer, he stressed a lot on association because he lacked an association of devotees and he was alone and everything.
Yeah.
And then when he became Jayabharat, he did maybe
he was also alone.
Yeah, in a devotee community, we say, okay, we need more association of devotees if you are alone and where you come to. So that's your mistake. You rectify the mistake by taking positive.
Yeah.
But in the case of Jayabharat, he's avoiding more, and then he is like, you know, oh, my mistake, I should be alone, like, you know.
Yeah.
So, how do we understand, you know, if we have something, we go with devotees, or we just stay there?
Yeah. Well, according to our acharyas, then the main cause was not the lack of association so much as the influence of the previous aparad. And the trace of the aparad remained in the bhava state and just agitated him, and then became attracted to the deer and he forgot to worship Vishnu. So that's the main cause. Of course, you can say if he had protection, fine, but then he had deliberately taken vanaprastha, and vanaprastha means you go off to the forest, so you don't have much association there except maybe your wife. But then that's not such a good association. Also, if you want to practice, you know, severely, so then he didn't take his wife either. So he was just following Vanaprastha as a king, so that's why he was alone like that. And of course, if he had good association, good, but said the main thing was the influence of the Aparan weakened his bhava stage. Now, if you get to bhava and prema, generally, they do not act like we act.
Associating with monies.
And be in association all the time. They may be quite different in their, how they act, because they're in such an elevated stage. They are associating with the Lord in their mind all the time, so they don't consider the material world at all. But then, of course, in bhava states, there is a little danger there also. Okay, Hare Krishna.